Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for December 24th, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. It's the final podcast of 2008, and this one is all about the favorite stories of the year from Science's online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
I'm here with David Grimm. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
Editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now. Now, David, I understand you've got a selection of the top 10 Science Now stories from 2008.
That's right, Rob. We're going to share with you five of our stories, and you can check out the rest on the site.
How did you choose the top 10?
Well, it's a mix of some of our favorite stories from the year and also some of our most popular stories from the year. And sometimes they're the same story and sometimes not so much.
Okay, so what's to start?
Well, Rob, we're going to start with a story about free will. And this is a story that we published back in April. And it deals with this question of, does our mind make decisions before we're even aware that those decisions have been made? And to do the study, researchers collected 14 subjects and they had them sit in an fMRI scanner. And this measures brain activity. And they asked the subjects to decide to push one of two buttons. One of these buttons was on their left and one was on the right. And the subjects had to tell the researchers exactly when they made that decision. They could take as long as they wanted to make the decision about whether to push the left button or the right button. But as soon as they decided to make that decision, they had to tell the researchers. And what the researchers found was that 10 seconds before the subjects thought they had actually made this decision, their brains had already made the decisions. In other words, the subjects had brain activity, which indicated that the subjects had decided whether to push the left button or the right button before the subjects even thought they had made that decision.
That sounds like a lot of lead time.
Yeah, that was a surprise to the researchers as well.
So what's this mean for free will?
Well, Rob, what this might say is that, you know, we often think of free will as something that arises from our conscious mind. But what this study suggests is that the decisions that we're making may arise in the subconscious, so that these decisions, while still our own, are happening on a level that we may not be aware of.
Well, I'm going to take the next decision point to go on to the next story. What is next in the list of top 10 or selection of top 5?
Next, we've got a story about a super frog. Now, it's not really a super frog, but it's a frog that reminds a lot of people of a superhero. And that superhero is Wolverine, which is an X-Men hero. And what's special about Wolverine is he has these metal claws that shoot from his knuckles that he can use to attack opponents. And Wolverine is also self-healing, which means when he resheaths these claws, his skin heals, and so his hands don't suffer any of the damage. There's a frog that seems to do this. This is an African frog from a family called Arthroleptidae. And what's special about this frog is it seems to have these claws that, just like Wolverine, pierce out from its skin whenever the frog gets scared. And researchers thought they had sort of seen this in museum specimens of the frog, but they figured, well, maybe it's just an artifact of these frogs being preserved in the museum. So a team went out in the wild and actually collected these frogs. And sure enough, they found that these frogs, unlike any other animal that's been described, pierces its own skin with these weapons and then resheaths these weapons. And what's really interesting, and another potential connection to Wolverine, is that these frogs, like other amphibians, have a remarkable ability for regeneration. And though it hasn't been shown yet, the suggestion is that once these frogs resheath their claws, that their skin regenerates, and it's like they had never poked their claws out of their skin in the first place, just like Wolverine.
Okay. Well, what's next on the list here?
Well, this next story gets into the even more spectacular world of quantum mechanics. And this story has to deal with a property called entanglement. And this is the idea that you can take two photons, shoot them so that they're even light years apart, and what you do to one affects the other. And physicists have been studying this property for a long time, but nobody's really been able to prove that it actually happens, or if it happens, how it happens. and hoping to get a little bit more information about entanglement, physicists at the University of Geneva in Switzerland took two photons and they sent them over fiber optic cables to two Swiss villages that were located 18 kilometers apart. And they tweaked these particles. So in very simple terms, if you can imagine them giving the particles a different color, they had, say, one particle decide to be red. And just as they would expect from entanglement, when one particle turned red, the other particle instantaneously turned red, even though it was 18 kilometers apart. Now, this particle could have, quote unquote, turned a variety of different colors, but it turned the exact same color as the other particle as soon as the other particle turned colors. And the research suggests two things. First of all, it's further evidence for entanglement because what you do to one particle quickly affects the other. But it also seems to break the speed limit for the speed of light. This happens so fast, this communication, if you will, between these two particles happens so fast that physicists say it clocks at more than 10,000 times the speed of light.
That's pretty spooky.
Well, it is. And in fact, Einstein himself called this phenomenon spooky action at a distance. And he wasn't being complimentary. He didn't believe such a thing could happen. But as time goes on, physicists are finding more and more evidence for it.
Okay, so we've heard about free will, Wolverine-like claws and a frog, and spooky quantum physics. That's three. What's next?
Well, Rob, let's throw in some earthquakes now. And this next story has to do with this idea, this very counterintuitive idea, that some of the world's most famous civilizations may have chosen to settle near very seismically active and thus earthquake-prone areas. And this idea came to a geologist on a camping trip. He was having trouble going to sleep one night and started thinking a lot about where some of the big epicenters for earthquakes are in the world and where some of the big civilizations of the past chose to locate. And he took out a map and compared the two. And what he found was when he looked at 15 sites, and these are sites everywhere from Rome and Corinth in Western Europe to Memphis and Jerusalem in the Middle East, he found that 13 of these 15 sites were located often within 75 kilometers of very active earthquake zones.
What advantage would that confer to these early societies to be in these seismically active areas?
Well, it's a great question, and nobody really knows the answer. But there are a few theories. One is that areas close to these plate boundaries tend to have ample water supplies. So people may have chosen to settle there just because there was more water there. Other people have speculated that volcanically active areas, and we know from previous research that earthquakes and volcanoes are linked, have richer soils for agriculture. That's another explanation. But my favorite theory has to do with the idea that the elders of these civilizations purposely chose to settle in these very unstable areas because they were trying to teach the younger generation a lesson, namely that life carries with it a lot of risk and you've got to be prepared to deal with it. So better to learn now than later. And I think the bottom line from the study is that a little shaking up isn't necessarily a recipe for disaster.
Okay, so the last of the five stories you've brought to us is...
The last story has to do with worm grunting.
Now, this isn't the top story of the year, is it?
This isn't the top story of the year, but it's definitely one of my favorites.
I think so, too. I remember this one in particular because it had this great sound. What is that?
That sound is the sound made by worm grunters. And worm grunters are people, especially in the panhandle of Florida, that earn their living. They go out to these pine forests near where they live before dawn. They hammer a wooden stake into the ground and they rhythmically scrape its top with a long, smooth piece of steel called a rooping iron. And what it does is it produces that sound.
Here it is.
And more importantly, what it does is it brings hundreds of earthworms out of the ground. And these people collect these worms and they sell them as fish bait. So people actually earn a living worm grunting. And scientists know about this phenomenon, but they don't know how it works or why it works.
Still?
Well, now they know. In this new study, a couple of teams went down to the 8th annual Sop Choppy Worm Gruntin Festival in Sop Choppy, Florida, and they watched a group of worm grunters do their thing. And not only did they watch, they also participated. And what they found is, first of all, that worm gruntin actually works. They measured the vibrations made by the wooden stakes and the rooping iron, and they measured them underground, and they found that they make specific frequencies, and when these specific frequencies are hit, the worms come out from under the ground. But more importantly, they think they figured out why the worms respond this way to this vibration. And there was two theories. One theory was that perhaps it was the pelting of rain on the ground that drove worms to the surface, and they would go to the surface because they didn't want to drown. And the other theory was perhaps the grunting noises were similar to the vibrations made by moles and other predators which hunt the worms underground. And it turns out the second theory is correct. When the team of researchers took a box full of soil, put 50 worms in it, and then introduced a mole and measured the vibrations that that mole made when hunting, they found that it, like nothing else, drove all these worms to the surface. So it's a cool story because it's a scientific question that may not have occurred to you, but it's a really fun story. And we've got five more just like this, including the most popular story of the year on the site.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
Have a great holiday.
You too.
And when will we see you back again?
Well, Science Now won't be publishing through the holidays, but we will be starting up again on January 5th.
So we'll see you here again for the January 9th podcast.
You bet.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can catch up on the latest science news and the full top 10 list of the most favorite stories of 2008 at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the December 24th, 2008 Science Podcast, the last podcast of the year. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.